You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
A new documentary called Sweetgrass by the husband and wife team, Lisa Barbash and Lucien Castaigne-Taylor, offers an unsentimental look at the twilight of the American West and its cowboy culture. It follows a group of sheep herders who are driving their huge flock to pasture 150 miles through the sweeping and strikingly beautiful landscape of Montana's Beartooth Mountains. The film begins a two-week run starting today at Film Forum on West Houston Street. I'm very pleased that it has brought Ms. Barbash and Mr. Castaigne-Taylor to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Thank you.
Where did the title come from? Sweetgrass. I'm assuming that they try to bring the sheep to the best-tasting grass?
Well, there's our background is in anthropology and film as well, and there's a classic 1925 ethnographic film called Grass that was shot in the mountains of Iran, and it involves a long trek of sheep. And it was one of our favorite films when we were in graduate school, and it just seemed too apt to make a sort of play on that title.
Is that what inspired you to even go to Montana and seek out these ranchers?
Well, actually, one more point to backtrack is that the county that the film was shot in is called Sweetgrass County. So it was an appealing name.
We misspelled it, but we didn't realize that. It's two words, and we've made it one word. But
well, how did you first hear of Lawrence Allstad or the sheep ranch and the culture that surrounds it?
We were living in Colorado at the time, just outside Boulder, Colorado, and there's a street in Boulder called Arapahoe Avenue that houses, among other things, two institutions. One is the Naropa Institute, that's this kind of post-Allen Ginsberg, post-Beat institute of higher education
connected to Tibetan Buddhism.
Tibetan Buddhism, New Ages, where people go to find themselves, or people send their wayward kids to become great creative writers. And then half a mile east is the international editorial and publishing headquarters of Soldier of Fortune, this mercenary kind of racist magazine. And so we got to thinking about what do these two institutions have in common. One seems to represent a certain kind of far left. One's definitely the libertarian far right. And then I realized they're both the same. They're both structural inversions of each other. So the far left people want to dance around a totem pole and get naked and surround themselves with incense. And the far right people want to realize their true inner self, although they don't speak the same language, by surrounding themselves with mines and so on and getting off the grid and being survivalists. We wanted to make a film about each of these two communities and through parallel action track back and forth, and we were having time finding characters and communities that we were happy with. And then actually some friends from New York City told us about an acquaintance of theirs who was leasing land to a sheepherder, a Norwegian-American sheepherder, fourth generation, who was the last person still to be trailing sheep up into the Absorca Beartooth Mountains.
So is there a long tradition of Norwegian-American sheepherding? I mean, when I think of sheep, Norway is not the first country that comes to mind.
Well, these people have been in that area for four generations, for over 100 years. There are little pockets of other ethnicities, even what is close as 50 miles away north. There's a Scottish community. This particular town and county are dominated by Norwegians.
And they call themselves cowboys, even though we're not talking about cows here. Would sheep herders be demeaning in their minds?
No. They call themselves sheep herders and cowboys, and they're not sort of mutually exclusive. But you're right, it's always cowboys are higher on the totem pole than sheep herders.
Although they make jokes about cowboys being mindless. There's a very funny joke, I don't want to tell it now, but there isn't a lot of talking in this film, so you remember any of the dialogue. It must have been it required incredible patience for you to do this. You do tell the story totally through images and don't explain anything. We have to figure it all out. That was obviously the approach that you decided upon from the start. What would have happened if you had said, you know, these Norwegian sheep herders had some titles at the beginning, have been doing this for four generations, and this is a chronicle of a trip that they took across Montana?
I think if we had done that, and believe me, we did think about it, and we it was suggested to us by many of our colleagues, but we decided not to do that because we didn't want people to watch the entire film with that in mind. And we didn't want people to constantly think, okay, this is going to be the last minute, or this is going to be the pivotal moment that is going to make them decide that they can never go back up into the mountains and do this again. We wanted people to trust us, an audience to trust us, and just sit back and let the images play and follow the story and then see the ending at the end.
And some of the images are just gorgeous. And there are scenes that have been described as hypnotic. When you're shooting them, are you thinking of them in those terms?
At times, maybe.
For example, the shearing of the sheep, which is a very long scene. And at the beginning, you wonder, how long are we going to see this? And then after a while, you just get caught up in the rhythms.
It's actually it's a really short scene, and most of the scenes are short, but it seems interminably long because there are only, in that case, two shots in the whole scene. And the average shot length on television is something like 3 seconds or 4 seconds, and the average shot length in Sweetgrass is perhaps 3 minutes or 4 minutes. So it's a radically different kind of relationship to time. You're right. I would say that when I was recording, I was listening to everybody, and indeed sheep, and even occasionally horses, and dogs wearing wireless lavalier microphones, and they could be up to 3 miles away from each other, up to a mile and a half away from me, and I'd be getting a totally radio frequency free recording of them. So I'd have these completely surreal kind of synchronicities of what people were doing that wasn't being seen on screen at all. Acoustically, it was incredibly intense as well as visually.
So you were handling the sound, and what were you doing, Lisa?
Minding the ranch. When we decided to do the film, we had a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old, and we went all together as a family, not really knowing what to expect up in the mountains of Montana. And when we got there, we found out that there were a lot of predator problems. There, gray wolves had been recently reintroduced into Yellowstone Park, and they were protected, federally protected, as were grizzly bears.
And these are threats to the sheep?
They're threats to the sheep and would have been threats to the children. So I stayed down on the flatlands while Lucien went up in the mountains, and I had my own camera, and I filmed a lot of town life, sort of the way Frederick Wiseman shoots institutions. I filmed town meetings, I filmed auctions, I filmed some rodeos, I filmed various sheepdog trials, all sorts of shooting events. And we were going to use that initially to sort of dress up the film. And what happened was Lucien came down from the mountains with footage that we felt was more compelling. So we decided to go with his, put mine on the shelf for perhaps a later film.
But this does capture traditions that we fear will die out. What happens if the sheep herders no longer do this? Does that mean that sheep herding will move to other places, or are there still areas where this sort of thing continues to be conducted?
Well, there are still sheep. So what's ending is the fact that there will never be transhumans. There will never be people trailing or driving their sheep up into these mountains again. They never can be. In 1975, it became a federally designated wilderness area, and all of the grazing permits since then were grandfathered in. There had never been allowed to be a new one, and this was the last one, and it's now no longer in existence. So there will never be sheep up there again. And it's part of the American conception of the environment, of the pristine, authentic environment, is that domesticated species are somehow unnatural. It's very different in the Alps and the Pyrenees.
Or New Zealand, for that matter.
Or New Zealand, exactly. But Americans don't eat lamb, and we don't wear wool. You know, there are 6 million, there are 6 million sheep in this country today, and in 50 years ago, there were 6 million sheep in Montana alone. So there were very few sheep left, and it's pretty hard to get by.
How did the herders act when you were filming them? You're doing this fly-on-the-wall approach. After a while, did you just become invisible?
I guess I would say there's sort of fly on the wall, and then what some people have called like fly in the eye, and then even fly in the soup. So when I wasn't filming, I was herding with them. I mean, I was a greenhorn. I didn't really know sheep. I grew up in Liverpool, and the Lake District was on the back door, but I wasn't a sheep herder. So I was learning on the fly about sheep and about herding and about the West. But I also, when I was filming, I'd wear a, or even when I wasn't actually, I'd wear an absurd kind of harness that would go up my spine and that would allow the camera to be suspended in front of my head, you know, from dawn till dusk. So it really became part of my identity.
Well, for example, you capture some pretty intimate moments. The one where one of the herders was literally crying on a cell phone to his mother about how hard his life was. And how miserable he was. And at this, of course, we also see him in the midst of this sweeping, beautiful landscape. And the irony is not lost on us.
Yeah.
But I wonder whether he would have said something like that if he had been thinking, well, there's a cameraman who's capturing all of this.
I think, yeah, I mean, I was right there with him. I was right next to him when it was happening. I just didn't feel it was appropriate, you know, for 3 minutes to leave the camera on him. And as you say, the irony wouldn't have been quite the same without the slow pan. But also when you think of the pastoral, you know, and this is definitely a pastoral film in a very different, much more ambivalent kind of register. You know, poets and painters since the classics, since Virgil, have waxed lyrical about the bucolic Arcadian lifestyle, but you never get any sense of what it's like to inhabit a sheepherder's body, of the effort, of the pain, of the exhaustion, and
you as well. You were there. You had physical. You suffered physically, didn't you?
Double foot surgery and advanced degenerative arthritis as a result of it. But I still put in a lot less work than I think the herders did themselves, or the sheep, for that matter. They probably work harder than anybody.
Well, the general sense of sheep is of these cute, fairly passive animals, although eventually you say you came to understand why the herders scream and curse at them.
Yes, yes. I think...
Are they that difficult?
Well, they are. They don't do what you want them to do. And initially, when they were driving the sheep up into the mountains, it was very difficult because the sheep would only move during a certain, just a few hours a day while it was still cool out.
And then they would resist?
Just stop and eat.
You just bogged down, they would stop, they're unmovable.
Yeah, you just can't move 3,000 bodies no matter how many dogs and neighbors you have helping you.
Would it be different with cows? Because it looks so easy in the movie John Wayne. Hey, and then they all whistle and...
There's no way you could get cattle up there. It would be absolutely impossible. I mean, sheep have always been relegated to the most marginal spaces, the most precipitous kind of slopes, you know, that basically that cattle and other kind of stock can never be herded on.
We also see in some night shots face-offs between the herders and the predators. There's a memorable scene at night when all that is visible are the reflective eyes of the sheep and some shadowy predator that... one of the herders fires his gun at.
Yeah.
He fires it towards it to scare it off. Mm-hmm. If you actually shot a grizzly bear, you could go to prison for 5 years or face a $150,000 fine. So it's one thing to... You're allowed to ward them off. You're actually not allowed to kill them in order to protect your flock.
So why was this this ranch sold in 2006? You say this was the last ranch to herd sheep in this manner. Is this culture going to disappear completely, at least in the United States?
I think more or less. As we said, Americans eat very little lamb for the most part. They wear very little wool for the most part now. So there isn't as much of a demand for sheep products as there has been in the past. The whole effort of driving the sheep up into the mountains, as we show, I hope, is extremely difficult. It's not very lucrative, so you can't pay your hired hands very much money. And
And the romance of the West is dying?
I wouldn't say the ranch of the West is dying, because what happened is the sheep ranchers sold off their ranch in that part of Montana and then bought another ranch in the northern part of the state closer to Canada, in eastern Montana, where the sun is raising cattle. And cattle has always been a much more prestigious job than sheep raising. So in a way, he's moved up in the world.
You said that you have all sorts of footage that didn't make it into this film. Should I assume that we're going to see another film, this time about what happens in the town?
Maybe in 10 years or so. We'll keep our eye on what's going on there.
Well, this film took 3 years to shoot, didn't it?
3 years to shoot and about 5 years to edit.
Wow. Were you doing anything else at the same time?
Well, we both work at Harvard University. I curate at the Peabody Museum. Lucien's a professor of anthropology and visual and environmental studies. And we've moved in the middle as well from Colorado to Boston.
And Lucien, are you past your physical problems?
No, I'm definitely well. In my later stages of middle age, kind of decrepitude, and my whole body's falling apart.
But you got to curse sheep every time you have a little pain in your leg?
I do, yeah, on a daily basis. But, you know, we're hoping to show some of the outtakes in the old wool district of Manhattan one of these months.
Are herders in real physical danger?
Anyone in the mountains is in some kind of danger. Grizzly bears have very poor eyesight. You're only going to lose your life to a grizzly bear if you surprise it, and almost certainly if you surprise her. It's really a sow with cubs, and if you're between the sow and the cubs. But they're much more aggressive, massively more aggressive than black bears. The wolves, you know, there's a lot of mythology around wolves, and actually the wolves that were reintroduced from Canada in 95 were a different subspecies, from a much bigger and more ferocious than the one that was there before. But they're a danger to livestock, to sheep, and they're not a danger to adult humans, really.
On the other hand, we here in New York would, would be very sympathetic to the introduction of wolves and don't understand why these people want to kill them. And kill them off and kill and really endanger them as a species. But I guess if I were a sheep herder, I would see the world quite differently.
I think sheep herders have always, anyone who's raised stock and is invested in their whole livelihood, their whole being is invested in their stock, obviously doesn't want to see that, you know, taken away from them. And there's also the sense of sheep are so biblically overdetermined. Actually, in all Abrahamic traditions, in Islam, in Judaism, in Christianity, there is this sense that of the innocent lambs, of the innocent sheep, that it is really your mission as a sheep herder, as a shepherd, to keep alive, and as long as they're going to be kept alive. Jesus himself was the Agnus Dei, was the Lamb of God, the church is his flock, etc., etc. So there's this mission there that's huge as well, that really feels compromised by the reintroduction of wolves, which was not a decision made locally, right or wrong, it was a decision made in D.C. by middle-class educated people over the backs of the local population. So there's some sense more of political disenfranchisement in the fact that their voices are not a part of the mix.
My great thanks to the two of you for being on our show, Lucien Castaigne-Taylor and Lisa Barbash. Their film Sweetgrass opens today at the Film Forum, and we'll be there for 2 weeks. It's been a great pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.